Our second case for this morning is Strauss against Chubb Indemnity Insurance, 132580 and others. Mr. Schenck, if you're ready.
May it please the court, counsel. Todd Schenck on behalf of appellant, the Chubb defendants. In the Miller case, this court stated a latent injury unknown and unknowable when coverage began must at least be covered by an insurer on the risk at the time it manifests. In this appeal, we submit that it is covered by only that insurer.
But you know, there's an interesting thing about your argument, and maybe you can help me with it. Actually, there are a number of interesting things here, but when the district court focuses on the Chartis policy, it draws a line from the in terms of this accruing damage to the house from the beginning of the Chartis policy forward. So the amount of damages that the Strausses receive under that policy is about $85,000 and change. So it's not the full. So at least as the Chartis policy is understood, the period of time before 2010, I think, is when it's first issued, isn't covered. And I guess according to your view, that was a mistake on the district court judge's part, and in fact the full $733,000 should have been attributed to the Chartis policy. I find this, you know, difficult because it seems to me you make a powerful point to say that just because your policy was in effect during certain years, it shouldn't stretch out to the year 2100. It seems like a very reasonable point to make. On the other hand, there's a bit of heads I win, tails you lose here, because the occurrence, if we define the occurrence as something that begins when the house is built, and that, at least in terms of your policies, ends at the moment that your policy expires, you'd be responsible for the damage up until 2005. But not thereafter, because of the fact that occurrences from your point of view end when your policy ends.
I think all of your argument is premised upon just something that may be not clear to you from the record.
My argument is premised on reading the policy, because actually I'll tell you, in terms of your discussions of Wisconsin law, as I understand it, these are the kinds of laws that are default provisions, and that the parties can contract around statutes of limitations, you know, amount of time in which to raise claims. So I'm trying to look at this strictly from the point of view of the policy language.
Right, let me address the question about Chartis, and then I'll turn immediately to the policy language. It was Chartis's position, not the district court's position, that only damage, active damage during the Chartis policy period was what Chartis owed. Chartis voluntarily paid the $85,000, but they were sued because it was the Strauss's position. No, you owe the entire amount jointly and severally with every other carrier who was ever on the risk at any time when the damage took place.
I get that, but what I'm concerned about, if one were to pick up your brief and not read anything else about this case, you would think that the plaintiffs had just walked away from the opportunity to get full recovery from Chartis. That's wrong. That just isn't what wound up happening. And so I find it a little troubling, you know, not to really engage with the reality of what was going on here.
And the reality was the Strausses sued Chartis as well as Chubb and wanted full.
Yet the district court, as I read the district court's opinion, the district court didn't think they should recover for the pre-2010 damages from Chartis. That's why it gets capped.
Well, I think that's incorrect, and Chartis settled. So Chartis did pay more than the $85,000. There was a settlement because that was still an issue in dispute that was going to go to trial.
Right. It settles against the backdrop, though, of the district court's opinions.
And to the extent the district court suggested or said that only active damage during the Chartis policy would be covered, we would disagree with that because that's violative of the manifestation trigger. Any damage that's latent and unknown but then manifests during your policy period is covered by that policy. You can't argue under a manifestation trigger, well, that damage took place before our policy incepted.
Well, how is that consistent with your position on the statute of limitations, or rather on the policy of limitations period? Because I understand your position to be that you can be responsible only for losses that occurred during your policy, right?
Correct. And a loss is defined by case law as a discovery of damage which causes a financial deprivation. Loss is not physical damage.
Well, we don't have a discovery rule, though, do we?
Well,
you're
discovery is not. In learning of or damage manifesting.
Well, let's back up a second. Your position on the policy limitations period is that your policy covers only occurrences during the life of the policy, right?
The suit limitation clause in the policy
just
says.
Answer Judge Hamilton's question. Is that has he correctly described the limited thing?
Well, not the suit limitation clause. That's not correct. There's a condition in the policy that says we cover losses occurring during the policy
yes.
period. And then there's a suit limitation clause.
And it
clause.
Defines the term occurrence, which is very common in insurance policies.
Mm-hmm. And then there's a suit limitation clause that says you must bring suit within 1 year after a loss occurs.
Right.
Now.
Okay. So you take the position that your policy would cover only damages that occurred during the life of your policy, correct?
No, and I think that's where...
Well, I think it does. I think you're conflating. I think the answer, as I understand your brief to Judge Hamilton's question, is yes, but you think, remains to be decided, but you think that they didn't comply with the legal action against us clause and complain about that damage within 1 year of the end of the policy. At least that's one of your arguments, that that clause is what bars things. And had they somehow discovered it within that 1 year after the end of the policy, you'd be on the hook for the full occurrence, since continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same general conditions, unless excluded, is considered to be one occurrence.
First and foremost, the policy only covers loss during the policy period, not physical damage or physical loss during the policy period. You have to have a loss during the policy period. That is discovery of the damage that might have occurred before the policy started.
What do you think loss means?
The case law is very clear. Loss means a financial deprivation.
Right. So you don't think a diminution in the value of a house is a loss?
It is, but it has to be discovered to have any sort of
this is like if a tree falls in the forest, does anybody hear it? I mean, in this case, the value of this house is diminishing with every drip of rainwater or whatever it was that was getting in there.
Before there's any discovery of damage, the house's listed value would be the same as if there was no damage going on behind the walls.
If an inspector had come, as almost virtually every home buyer insists on, the loss would have been discovered at that moment.
Exactly. And then there's a manifestation of a loss, and that would trigger coverage.
So the loss was there all along.
Well, it's latent, and the courts all say
people
that
people don't just go hire inspectors.
Well, let's suppose somebody else had insured the policy for had insured this house for it through its construction in the first 5 years that the Strausses were in it, okay? And then Chubb comes in, and during the first year of your policy, they want to sell. An inspector comes in and discovers there's this progressive damage that's been going on. Are you telling us Chubb would be on the hook for the entire diminution of value?
Yes. That's exactly what happened in the Miller case, decided by this court. Safeco was on the hook for the entire loss, even though it was undisputed that the damage started and was progressive but latent until it was discovered during the Safeco policy.
I thought that was all Safeco policies.
There was no policy issued by Safeco prior to the one that was triggered. That same result, putting the loss during the policy when all the damage was discovered, took place in the Lotz case and in many of the other manifestation trigger cases we've cited. So that's not an unusual result.
But that's not what you really wrote in that policy, right? Judge Wood quoted it before. It covers only two occurrences that take place while the policy's in effect. That's the first part. Occurrence is a loss or accident to which the supply is occurring within the period. Continuous or repeated exposure to substantially the same conditions is considered to be an occurrence. So you actually sold this masterpiece policy to a fairly new high-end homeowner, or high-end owner, owner of a high-end house, with the understanding that they were buying something that was probably more expensive on the market, and you agreed to cover that potential risk. And at that time, your risk was probably fairly low since it was only 4 years old.
The policy definition of occurrence, first and foremost, says we cover a loss occurring within the policy period. That language is very common. And if you look
at the continuous or repeated exposure is the occurrence. I mean, how do you justify that distinction?
Let me address that second sentence. Continuous or repeated exposure is deemed one occurrence. That sentence really has no application here because this isn't a dispute over whether there are multiple occurrences or one occurrence. This is just a dispute over whether there's one continuous occurrence or one occurrence at a finite point in time upon discovery. That sentence does come into play in other types of factual situations where you might have manifestations of different types of losses at different times. And does the insured owe multiple deductibles? No. That sentence says all those different manifestations are all due to the same continuous or repeated exposure.
But it has a different application to this case. I'm not sure I agree with you that it's irrelevant to this case. I know that there are the cases about, you know, whether if you're in a hurricane, you know, you've got two occurrences or one occurrence, et cetera. But this, I think, is important since the occurrence isn't finished until the water damage is over, and that is quite pertinent to whether the Strauss is sued in time. So it's just a different issue that it may have some application to.
I see I'm in my rebuttal time. I will address that point on my rebuttal. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Murdoch.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Andrea Murdoch, appearing for appellees Randall Strauss and Diane Strauss. We're here today on Chubb's insurance policy, and on the very first page of Chubb's insurance policy, that appendix page 56, it states, you now own one of the most highly regarded insurance policies. Yet Chubb is asking this Court to disregard that highly regarded insurance policy and turn to bright line rules for continuous trigger and statute of limitations.
So here's what worries me. I mean, I've already indicated it. What worries me about your position, which is the notion that this just goes on in perpetuity. A company can write an insurance policy that, say, covers the years, to make it round numbers, you know, from 1995 to 2005, and along 2030, somebody in a house can discover that there was a construction flaw and reach all the way back for all of the damages, even for the many years since the policy expires. That troubles me quite a bit as a matter of public policy.
That is the position in Wisconsin, though, according to Wisconsin courts. In the plastics engineering case, which applied occurrence language similar to the language that we have in our policy, they did reach back, I believe, to 1967 and considered that entire loss as one loss.
But was that a third-party? I think that
that was a third-party case.
The policy considerations are quite different in first-party and third-party because in third-party situations, you are worried about these external things that are going to happen, whether it's an actor, whether it's a weather event or whatever it is, whereas first-party insurance is really just a way of managing your own finances. There are all sorts of economic incentives for how much first-party insurance you may have. And I will remind you, I'm sure you know this, you know, in the commercial general liability insurance area, the entire industry switched from occurrence policies to claims-made policies precisely to cut off these long tails. And I'm just not sure that the language of this policy, putting even to one side whatever the background legal rules are, supports this very expansive notion for first-party claims. What good reason would you have to extend the third-party rule to first-party?
If you're talking about the third-party rule for continuous ongoing losses?
Or for actually anything. But, yeah, we'll focus on that rule. Okay. That's fine.
It's based on Chubb's policy language. The policy language that Chubb chose to use, it said that it would cover all risk of physical loss occurring during the policy period, as was noted earlier by
the court. But, of course, the risk, the policy loss, the diminution in value of the house from 2005 onward was not during the policy period of any Chubb entity. Other companies by that time were selling the insurance. And I think if you're going to look at the policy language, you need to grapple with the legal action against us clause that says you also agree to bring any action against us within 1 year after a loss occurs.
Correct. And under Wisconsin law, the society case holds that a progressive loss similar to what we have here in the Strauss's case occurs continuously from exposure, which in this case was 1994 when that first drop of water physically damaged the house, all the way up to 2010 when it manifested.
But it wasn't a loss after 2005 that Chubb was covering.
How
would you price an insurance policy for damages for a durable good like a house that could easily last 75 or 100 years? Maybe more with some houses, if you have no idea, you know, 50 years later that some defect that turns out to have been there all along may show up. I don't know how you would work that out actuarially.
And frankly, I don't either, Judge.
It's a bad rule.
I don't know how Chubb prices its policies, but I do know that Chubb chooses its policy language, and it chose to use the same occurrence definition for its first-party coverages as it did for its liability third-party coverages in this policy. And because it chose to use that same definition, it's falling under Wisconsin law that holds that one occurrence, as long as any portion of that occurrence occurs during the Chubb policy period, Chubb is on the hook for that entire loss.
I'm following you on the merits. That is, this is a policy written in terms of a continuous occurrence, a continuous trigger. Where I have trouble is, as Judge Wood was indicating, is with the sue within 1 year of the loss. Can you tell us how Wisconsin law handles those time limits for suit in liability policies where you've got continuous exposure, one long-term occurrence?
Sure. There are really two parts to the suit limitation provision. Part of it deals with statute, according to Chubb's argument.
Forget the statute.
Set aside. Okay.
The policy clearly trumps. Okay, so we've got sue within 1 year of the loss.
Yes.
How does that work in terms of liability policies, where you have this continuous occurrence?
Because the loss under Wisconsin law is considered to be the entire period of occurrence, then that entire period of occurrence, once that loss completes, that's when the clock starts running. So in our case, we had a loss that began in 1994 and occurred continuously all the way up through the point of manifestation, which was in 2010. It's our position that that is the point, the very earliest point at which the clock could have begun running.
Because with the manifestation.
Loss occurred. Okay. Correct.
All right. One of the things that troubles me about that is we've got the Borgen case, which seems to be telling us discovery is not the issue.
Correct.
Right?
And we are not asking for
different facts.
We are not asking for a discovery rule. Mm-hmm. Under a discovery rule that was at issue in Borgen, mm-hmm. that would take a loss that had, for example, a hail loss, as was at issue in Borgen, a loss that occurs and incepts on one date. You have one point in time. And they said that they would not apply a discovery rule such that the loss is complete but not discovered for a year. So there's that period in between when the loss is not occurring. Our situation is different. we have a loss that's occurring continuously all the way up to manifestation. So it's not a discovery rule. It's under society, which says that that loss is continuous for that entire period. It's still occurring for that whole period.
So you think it's possible that the loss might come to an end, I'll say kind of accidentally, if it had been a bad roof, and just for whatever reason, they had decided to replace the roof, they decided they want cedar shakes instead of an asphalt roof, and it brought the loss to an end, even though they weren't actually trying to do that. That would end the period, even though there's no discovery.
Yes, if the loss were no longer occurring and that physical damage were no longer occurring to the property, that would be the point at which the clock would start running. But we didn't have that in this case. The parties stipulated to a judgment whereby they agreed factually that the loss was occurring from 1994 all the way up to 2010, that physical damage was occurring during that entire period.
I think you must also be relying on a hidden, slightly hidden proposition that insured parties really have no incentive, you know, to ignore damaging things that are happening to their property. Their personal incentive is to act as soon as possible anyway, so you don't need some legal rule that prods them to be diligent.
Correct. There was no evidence in this case at all that the Strausses sat back and watched damage happen to their house and just didn't do anything about it. And that's also discussed in the Vogel case where the court said, look, we aren't going to require insureds to dismantle their house every year to try to find hidden damage. The damage that we had in this case was occurring within the building envelope. It wasn't visible to anybody. And the court in Wisconsin has said, we're not going to require people to go above and beyond to these absurd lengths just to make sure that nothing is happening to their house during a policy period. That's not what Wisconsin courts require.
I share some of Judge Wood's concerns about this idea of liability lasting forever. But I gather your position on that is that those are concerns that could be addressed by policy language.
Correct. If Chubb has raised its concerns. If it wants to deal with those concerns, the proper venue for that is by going to its underwriting department, to its policy drafters, and to have them change the language of the policy to mean something different than what it does right now. The proper venue isn't to come to this court and ask the court to relieve it from its contractual obligations.
If Chubb is right, then it sounds like you all made a mistake in settling with Chartis. Right?
I don't think that we made a mistake in settling with Chartis.
Why not?
Let me back up. I think that the questions during during Mr. Shank's arguments were that the court capped Chartis's damages at $85,000.
Just the proportion of the damage to the property that occurred during the Chartis policy.
So the court seems to be talking about ensuing loss, you know, and saying that's what starts when Chartis is there.
The court, as I read the decision and as I understand the facts of this case, did not cap the damages at $85,000. It didn't cap the damages to a point that reaches back to the first part of the Chartis policy period. In other words, there was no allocation that was performed by the district court. And Chubb isn't before this court asking this court to have an allocation of damages either. Again,
it wants off the hook entirely. We get that, I think. But in laying out the various alternatives here for long-term damage with changing insurers, I mean, one option is everybody's on the hook, joint and several liability for the whole shebang. Another policy is a kind of linear proportional allocation among everybody so that a property owner has to sue everybody they've ever insured with. Chubb is telling us, no, just go after whoever has the policy when the damage manifests itself. And the good news for us is that at least under the Coase theorem, everybody can negotiate around those complications with policy language. But we still have to deal with the sunk losses here.
Correct. And so what we are left with here is Chubb's policy. It used language that requires it to apply the continuous trigger theory. And under that continuous trigger theory, there's no allocation. All the insurance companies who were on the risk or who covered the property during the period when the loss, when the physical damage was occurring to the property, are on the hook. It is joint and several. And I appreciate that they don't like that result right now, but that's the result that we have in our case. And I think even Chubb admitted that this is a very unique case. There aren't many cases where you have this type of ongoing progressive loss. So when the court is ruling on this, it's not as if the court is giving some generalized rule that should apply to all insurance policies from this point forward. In most cases, there is going to be a loss that occurs and incepts at one point. We, however, have a more unique situation, which was anticipated by the Chubb policies, that there could be continued ongoing exposure to the same or substantially same conditions. And under that language, it requires application of the continuous trigger theory. If Chubb wants a different result, it has every right to do that by rewriting its policy language. But in this case, they're stuck with what they wrote. If the court does not have any further questions, I believe that concludes my arguments this morning.
Thank you.
Apparently not. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Anything further, Mr. Schenck? I'm thinking the answer is yes.
Just to make this very clear, look, appendix page 29 makes it very clear that the district court said each and every policy on the risk from manifestation, from the point the damage begins through manifestation, covers the entire loss. So this was a joint and several approach. There was no allocation done. Now, in the Strauss's brief, and again here today, they have argued that the Chubb policy covers physical loss occurring during the policy period. That's not what our policy says. It covers loss occurring during the policy period. There are other places in the policy where it says we cover physical loss, but when we're talking about confining coverage to the policy period, we're not talking about physical loss. We're talking about loss, which is financial deprivation. So if we have a financial deprivation that's experienced during the policy, that's the loss, and that must occur during the policy period. So there's no need for us to rewrite our policies. They already say exactly what we're advocating here, which is manifestation trigger. And all the courts that have applied manifestation have addressed the same language, loss occurring during the policy period. There are a few cases that have been cited to this court where courts have applied some other rule other than manifestation. They involve different policy language. Those policies covered physical damage during the policy period, which is like a third-party liability policy. And that's one reason you can get to a continuous trigger, because there's physical damage during multiple policies. Our policy doesn't say that. It says loss occurring during the policy period. There isn't a single case.
It does define a covered loss as all risk of physical loss.
Correct.
To your house. So
that's a covered loss. You need that. But then you need separately a loss occurring during the policy period. And there are many courts.
Well, why wouldn't loss mean a covered loss? Why? What? Where in the policy does it define the term loss to mean something different from a covered loss? You would think covered loss would be a narrower
There's
term.
No definition of the word loss in the policy.
So
the courts,
why isn't it sensible then to say maybe there's some universe of losses and you have written insurance for a subset of that universe, namely the covered losses, and the covered losses include all risk of physical loss to the house or other covered property?
The policy says physical loss when that's what's intended. It says loss when what is intended is a financial deprivation. And if you read the policy, there are many places where just the term loss, without the term physical in front of it, is used. Those provisions make no sense if you apply a continuous trigger. For example, the policy says we set the limit based upon the stated limit plus an inflation adjustment for the CPI as of the date of loss. But what's the date of loss in the continuous trigger? The policy says we will repair the house using the same workmanship and materials as existed on the date of loss. What's the date of loss under a continuous trigger? The house could have had an addition, a kitchen remodel, a basement renovation. You could be insuring a completely
Isn't that a problem
business.
With the policy?
As no.
Because you all define loss or occurrences to include these continuous events, right?
I absolutely don't think that's a problem in the policy, because every time there's an issue with timing, the policy uses the term loss, not physical loss.
But you didn't define loss as financial deprivation.
The courts have done that for us consistently. Insurance companies like my client are entitled to rely upon those very consistent definitions of the term loss that have been given in the case law since 1893 by the Wisconsin case that we've cited, the Hart case. If you have no more questions, that concludes our argument.
Apparently not. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We will take the case under advisement.